Hello, you Awakening Wonders. They're on Spotify, Apple, Stink Whistle, Gurgle Dot, or wherever you download your podcast these days to remain at least peripherally connected to some tendril of truth in a bewildering miasma of lies and propaganda. We appreciate you and we love you. You're part of our community. So that's why we're very happy to give you an audio version of our live Rumble show 5 days a week. It's on Monday to Friday. We decipher the latest news stories. We break down current topics that the mainstream media should be covering. And if they aren't, then we critique why they're not and what they are covering. Every week as well, right? We do brilliant conversations with people like Jordan Peterson, RFK, Tucker Carlson, Sam Harris, Vandana Shiva, Gabor Mate. These things are already up and you can listen to them now. So remember, this is an audio version of our daily live show. To tune in live, go to rumble.com/Russell Brand. You'll find it easily and I hope that you will love it. Now please enjoy this episode of Stay Free with Russell Brand. Thanks.
No, here's the fucking news.
Hello there, you Awakening Wonders. Thanks for joining me today for Stay Free with Russell Brand. Today we have one of those guests that's going to change the way you think about globalism, who's going to change the way you think about the establishment, who's going to help you to understand the origins of the WHO and how there's always been a criminal element to global bureaucracies that, if it's explained to you, makes clear and plain sense. You will have seen our interview with Mike Benz, how Mike Benz explained how the deep state forms relationships with what I would call cartilage organisations that ensure that corporations can benefit from globalist activity. Dave Martin will help you to understand how various bureaucracies benefit from forms of legislation and ultimately oppression that negatively affect you. He explains it beautifully and incredibly, and you could have joined us live for that conversation if you are an Awakened Wonder, because one of the things we do for our community is create opportunities for you to join us for these conversations. People like Jumpin' Jeff, they were in the chat when we were chatting to Dave Martin. People like Ashella, they were there when we were chatting to Dave Martin. And if you want to join us for that, as well as see our video on Antarctica and the various conspiracies that surround that extraordinary place, and if you want to be a member of our book club, and if you want to meditate every single week and pray with us, then consider trying us for 1 month and seeing if you like what we offer. Let's get into our conversation with Dave Martin now. Remember, concentrate. This, as I say, like the Mike Benz conversation, is an interview that if you watched it 3 or 4 times and memorized it, it's like going to some sort of informal university to tool you up for conversations with people that advocate for the establishment, that believe that the legacy media is telling the truth, and that we don't have an extraordinary opportunity on our hands to overthrow institutional corruption at the highest level. For the first 15 minutes, we'll be on YouTube. Then we'll be exclusively streaming at our home, Rumble. So you can enjoy this first part wherever you are, but ultimately, to speak freely, you have to get onto Rumble. Because why? Because YouTube are part of a set of organizations that participate in the kind of censorship that we radically oppose. You know that. Without further ado, let's begin our conversation with Dave Martin, the scientist and inventor who from the beginning of the pandemic period has been holding institutions and big corporations to account. Dave Martin, welcome to the show.
Russell, so good to be here. It's awesome to be with you and your community.
You look like you're in a beautiful gothic enclave wearing your characteristic trademark Dickie bow. You look magnificent and wonderful. Thank you for everything you do for this community of illumination, and thank you for joining us today.
It's always an honor to be here, Russell. I count it as a blessing.
Do you consider this, Dave, to be a time of reckoning and a time of revelation? I mean, at least first, somewhat parochially, the letter from members of the GOP to the Senate. I think 49 members have written to oppose the WHO treaty, saying it's against the principles of democracy, even on the most rudimentary level. They've not been given a standard 4-month period to discuss it. They demand that as a minimum. The UK are pushing back on the WHO treaty, and even though it's clear that the WHO have tried to mask some of its more nefarious intent behind vagueness, it's still a treaty that would grant them the ability to impose lockdowns, impose medical measures including mass inoculation, and significantly censor content that they do not like. It's essentially could be called the "we're going to put Joe Rogan inside a steel cube" next time we try and pull this move treaty.
Yeah, well, listen, you know, It's funny when you know that somebody has something to hide. It's one thing when you actually see that they enshrine the hiding into the actual language of their agreement. It's an entirely different thing. So yeah, the great news is we've got a world where we've been told that we're not supposed to have any conversations, we're not supposed to talk, we're not supposed to have any free inquiry, and they want to make absolutely certain that none of us have a chance to talk and have free inquiry. So giant shock. Bad news for them is we will have free inquiry and we will continue to talk.
I have a sense that you have always deeply understood from the beginning of the pandemic period and the measures that were implemented that something seismic was happening. But even to talk of the scale of the challenge, even though I suppose even the most parochial or no quotidian framing would acknowledge that it's global by nature of the fact that it's a pandemic, implies that this is something unprecedented. It seems to me that you understood that bureaucracies, unelected bureaucracies, pose a greater threat than the what we're invited to be terrified of, figures like populist figures like Trump and counterparts across the world. It seems like you've understood that. And I almost get the sense, Dave, being a follower of your content, that you see it not only in material and rational terms, although you are always clear about your working out on the material, rational aspects of these arguments, that you seem to suggest to me that something even darker and deeper is happening. Did you have that understanding right from the beginning of the pandemic because it fitted in with a worldview that you already had?
Well, not only that, Russell, if we go back, my first congressional testimony was in 1983.
Whoa.
So, yeah, does it go back a bit? Goes back a long way. I don't know if you recall, but back in the end of the Carter administration, there was the resurgence of what was meant to be the roots of a draft, a compulsory military service program in the United States. And that was in the lead up to what was going to become the Iran-Contra scandal. We were going to try to figure out how to make sure that American men and women, at the time young men, but it became men and women, were going to be forced into supporting the cover story arguments for every conflict we wanted to get into. And as a 16-year-old in Congress, and you heard that right, it was 1983, I was 16 years old, I testified against the mandatory military service, suggesting that it actually would be a good idea to have the American people understand the role and the need to be involved in some form of service, but to actually have options that didn't include military service, because at the time it was very clear in 1983 that the war on drugs was not a war on drugs, that the war on terror was not a war on terror, that none of these things were absolutely real. As a matter of fact, it was the ongoing, really continuation of something that goes back ironically to 1604, which is the fact that since 1604, since the establishment of the British East India Company, we have had a business plan that has been create a drug trade, create a war to mask it, get the populace to support whatever the version of the war narrative is, and we just hit rinse and repeat. And so whether it was, you know, the opium trade in the 1830s when we actually had the opium wars, whether it was the establishment of what became the League of Nations, which most people don't know was the Committee on Opium Trade. Did you hear me? The Committee on Opium Trade. That's where we started the UN. I mean, when you sit there and go, this has been a drug dealing racket for the last 250 years to be conservative, and we could go back and argue that it's since 1604, there is no surprise. When you have the game plan, it's not a worldview. It's actually just going, we've got a game plan. It keeps working. The public still falls for it. So let's hit play again. And that's exactly what's happening.
This is a bit like the Tucker Putin conversation, when Tucker asks about the origins of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the answer begins like, the Mongols were in the plainlands, and
like exactly,
because it's fascinating to consider that I suppose what is significant from the perspective of a British person is you're talking about the conflation of the interests of commerce and trade with the interests of an empire, and how
that's exactly right.
Nationhood itself as a concept, the state masks for the population that are governed that the true interest and intent of the state are elitist interests masked behind a cavalcade of reasons that can be amplified or edited out according to what's working. I like that you talk about the significance of the box wars and the opium wars. I didn't know that the League of Nations was established to regulate the opium trade, which was legal till, you know, relatively recently, and is still, I suppose, legal in
some
form. Well,
it's still entirely legal. It's just called pharmaceuticals.
We've called it a different word now, and we would like you to pretend that you can't see that.
Exactly right. That's the first time that's ever happened, the rebranding to make sure that the criminal conspirators get away with the crime. Giant shock. Don't call it bank robbery. Call it the relinquishment of unnecessary cash deposits in an institution. And all of a sudden, it's not bank robbery anymore.
Okay, then, Dave. Then what if this is something that it sounds like you've understood since you were, you know, transitioning, forgive the use of the word, from a child to a man, that you understood that state is using phony wars to legitimize authoritarianism and the manipulation of the population. You listed a set of phony wars there. What was unique about the pandemic? Was it that many previously covert interests became temporarily visible, like the recent Aurora Borealis in Northern Europe? Suddenly, something that is always there became visible to a new population. Hang on a minute, the pharmaceutical industry and the state are operating in conjunction with these unelected bureaucratic bodies in order to centralize authority and generate profit. Is that what it was?
Well, so I think there's two things that make the COVID situation somewhat dramatic, at least. I wouldn't say unprecedented, but certainly dramatic, because we can actually make the argument that certainly the establishment of the Commonwealth was the legitimization of the British East India Company, and that company's 86% of its trade was opium. So unambiguously, this is not a new phenomenon. The difference probably is the degree to which the audacity of the direct suppression of civil and human rights was part and parcel of this exercise. And I've seen it, as I've said many times, as a marketing exercise to see exactly how far the complicit population will go before they start pushing back. Because I think that's really what it was. I think this was a market test more than it was a substantive act. And the fact is that the market test was to see how far humans are willing to allow themselves to be caged, curtailed, limited, delimited, everything else. And I think that what we really did was we had a market test on humanity, and humanity came with a, let's just say, not a passing grade.
Have you got any corroborating evidence to suggest that indicates or even proves that it was that? Are there
conversations? Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, listen, you only have to go to the Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, look at the decade of vaccines that they published in 2011. They actually said that they were going to do this. They said by 2020, we were going to have a universal acceptance, a universal vaccine mandate across the world on a universal platform. And then in September 18th of 2019, they specifically said that there would be an accidental or deliberate release of a lethal respiratory pathogen. This comes right out of their document, Global Preparedness Monitoring Board, September 18th, 2019. And in that document, they said the purpose of it was so that by September 2020, the world would have a universal vaccine plan. Period. That's not an allegation, that's an accusation, because it's reading right out of their script. So this is not putting the pieces together. This is something basic. I know it challenges a lot of people, but it's called literacy. You just have to read their plan. And if you actually, God forbid, read the words on the page, you actually see that this was nothing but a market test, which is the reason why we have Answer Corporation, ATI, Forsmarsh, and the companies that were involved in the rollout of this pandemic We have them all setting up the marketing program, which was the launch of Event 201 and other things, where they actually told us exactly what was going to happen. They told us what the media was going to sound like. They told us what the marketing was going to sound like. They told us all of these things in advance of this bullshit story of patient one in Wuhan. All of this was theater to get the public to accept the next round of the drug trade. And the next round of the drug trade is genetically modified humans.
We're going to have to park this conversation for people watching the stream on YouTube right now. As you can already sense, we're going to stray in areas that the Trusted News Initiative and various other conglomerations of censorship and NGOs that are deployed to use AI to censor your free speech, to legitimize ways to censor and control you and smear dissenters. They'll be up in arms. They'll be panicking right about now. If you want to see the rest of the conversation, click the link in the description. Go over to Rumble. And remember, consider becoming an awakened wonder. There's additional content as well as the great thrill of being part of a movement committed to real radical change. Now, see you in a few seconds. Extraordinary. I wonder if I might ask you the somewhat taxing favor that by the time we are doing this now for our community on Locals, so if you become an awakened wonder, you can join us for these conversations and put your questions to our treasured guests like Dave. I wonder if by the time we stream this on Friday, if you could send us some links that we can post in the chat.
Absolutely.
For example, in particular, the various documents that you've referred to that permit you to make those accusations, just so that we can learn together from the brilliant work that you've done in compiling these narratives. I mean, it's extraordinarily significant. So really what you're saying is that many of them, what seemed to be the most outlandish statements that could be located online at the commencement of the pandemic, are closer to the truth than what you would see on the BBC or NBC or the New York Times. The people that are saying this is a staged event, this is a plandemic, this is a mass market attempt to see if you can assert civilization control. Now, that, how do you tally that with something like the discovery that in Ukraine, through DIA, they are now monitoring and observing Ukrainian transactions and have tied digital identity to the ability to shut down bank accounts, causing some Ukrainian civilians that refuse the conscript to have their assets frozen? Do you think that the control of finance, social credit scores, digital ID are part of this, launch, as you very explicitly said, next phase of the drug phase, genetically engineered or altered humans? Do you think part of that is civilian management through technological dictatorship?
Well, no question. It's not by accident. Dustin Moskowitz, the name I love to mention that nobody seems to ever bother to keep reciting, and I encourage people to do it. But Dustin Moskowitz, the co-founder of Facebook and the guy behind paying for Event 201 and the guy behind paying for a number of other things, including his joint venture with the Wellcome Trust through Syncova and a number of funding sources. This program is about, once again, making sure that there is an ability to access a control mechanism on human beings. And by genetically modifying people with mRNA, by doing all sorts of those kinds of manipulations, and then by encouraging things like central bank digital currencies and all of the kinds of things we're supposed to track on our phones, the vaccine passport or the personal identity transactions, all of these things are meant to control and limit the ability for the free association and the free movement of thoughts and idea and people. If you're going to actually control and manipulate a population, what you have to do is effectively create house arrest for the non-compliant. And it turns out that house arrest for the non-compliant is what I said in my interview in April of 2020. I said this entire program was the launch of the universal house arrest program. And what do I mean by that? What I mean is that by creating, using, by the way, the only tool that can subvert constitutional rights, which is public health. Public health was written into the law as the way of subverting constitutional rights. And using public health as the means to do it, we have been placed under a virtual house arrest, and the technologies that are enabling that are going to be increasingly rolled out, whether it's your 5G, 6G personal identity chips, whether it's the things that you wear, it's the personal devices that monitor your behavior, the personal devices that monitor your health status. These are all meant to effectively be the anklet on your leg for the criminal that you are if you think you are entitled to liberty.
It's extraordinary how many of these measures have been observably introduced through commodity, the normalization of handheld technology, the normalization of biotech, the normalization of monitoring your sleep, monitoring your sugar levels. It's almost, do you suggest then that that's a process of familiarization that doesn't require the explicit complicity of the commercial entities involved in the marketing of those products, because they will simply sell a product if it's profitable, and the population will acquire those products if they believe that they are somehow beneficial. But once this infrastructure is in place and once these ideas have been normalized, they can be centralized and used coercively.
Yeah, Russell, let's take a page out of history. I've said many times that the debate between Westinghouse and Edison and Tesla is one that gets nostalgically thrown about as Tesla, this giant libertarian who was a victim of circumstances. People forget that he received several million dollars of funding from J.P. Morgan. So last time I checked, that doesn't make you a victim of anything. It makes you complicit. But that's me being judgmental, I suppose. But the fact of the matter is, what made electricity normalized, because remember, we used to use whale oil. You know, that's how we used to light our nights. We used to use oils and we used to use all sorts of other things to actually light our nights. But we started using electricity. But the problem is you couldn't make electricity work until you could do what? Put a meter on the outside of the house. Now, most people don't know that the Triplett Company from Bluffton, Ohio, is the company that figured out how to put a little device on the outside of every house that used to, you remember this when you were a kid, used to have a little dial that spun on the outside of the house and it just measured how much electricity was going in the house. It's about metering behavior, because by metering behavior, you can do two things. One, you can extract a tax on the public, whether they're using something or not. That's helpful. And the other thing is you can monitor and manipulate behavior, because if you want to, people are not playing the game, you just shut them off. There's no difference in right now an Apple Watch is no different than the power meter on the outside of your house in the 1920s or 30s. It is the monitoring system that you think is innocent and innocuous, but it becomes a permanent taxation and a permanent behavior control mechanism that you actually just blindly went along walking past it every day going, oh, look at the thing is spinning. Well, it's spinning, yes, but it's also monitoring, manipulating, and controlling your behavior.
It's becoming increasingly obvious that this relationship that you've described between the state and commercial interests, rather beautifully identifying the advent of the East India Tea Company as a sort of a moment of inception, continues abound, because as the great George Carlin said, where interests converge, no conspiracy is necessary. Corporate entities will, of course, always embrace the utility and benefits of new products and new systems of sale. We had a great conversation with Mike Benz where he explained how the CIA cutout was sponsoring Serge Brin and Larry Page even while they were doing their Stanford dissertations, and that the reason that Google got the run on the market when it came to Google Maps and satellite technology is because they were granted access to CIA spyware. Yep. And when you're told something like that, you feel like, yeah, of course, like a couple of kids didn't launch satellites into space and didn't like work out on a computer program. Oh, look, we can coagulate all of it. They simply were given it and repackaged and reskinned military technology paid for by taxpayers to be utilized for commerce. Presumably, if a back channel is kept open to the CIA, should they need access to that information?
Russell, if we go back to the Second World War, the program called Operation Paperclip became what was granted to a corporation in the United States called Ampex. If you've ever driven up 101 coming up into San Francisco, you remember the giant Ampex sign on the side of the road. Most people don't know that out of Ampex came little things like Dolby Sound. Did you know that? Dolby was a government classified technology. Why? Because by manipulating sound waves, you could actually manipulate human behavior. Everybody goes, oh, I've got Dolby surround sound. No, what you have is you have a classified technology to manipulate your brain and you've been told that that makes a better theater experience. Well, guess what? It does make a better theater experience. It turns the whole world that you're living in into the theater into which you are merely a little pawn in someone else's script. That's what it does. And that came out of Ampex Corporation, Oracle, that little company that no one's ever heard about. Oracle was what? It was a classified CIA project on figuring out how to do a serialization of data in what was then called database structures. And it turns out that that classified technology became a company that's ubiquitous and everybody runs on Oracle. But guess what Oracle was, and guess what Larry Ellison was? And by the way, employee at Ampex Corporation. Go back and look. The history of Ampex Corporation is the laundering of technology that came through defense acquisitions, most of which came out of the Second World War. A.M. Pontioff, the founder of Ampex Corporation, was not a scientist. He was actually the technology laundering arm of the defense infrastructure. And we sit there going, oh, no, no, it's innocent. It's the thing that we use in theaters. It makes the experience so much better. No, it doesn't. It controls your mind.
What we're saying then, Dave, is that the reason the pandemic period was significant for a lot of people is because, let's face it, there were a lot of people, among them Alex Jones, David Icke, you, plainly, and me in a more, what you might say, a kind of post-60s countercultural, never trust the man, Eastern mysticism, post-Beats type way, yeah. Was saying you cannot trust the establishment, you cannot trust the man. You can see how the civil rights movement was at the very centre of that. Curiously now, the civil aspects of the civil rights movement are now being utilised to legitimise further authoritarianism on the basis that the vulnerable groups are being protected. And I would also say legitimizing using cultural arguments to legitimize the fact that both parties in the United States of America ultimately work for the donor class, and I'm sure you will offer for interests that go far deeper and far beyond that. We talked a little while recently about George Soros and how significant George Soros's wealth is when you consider that much of it is derived from advanced knowledge of CIA activity when it comes to the disruption and often dissolution of nations. And these kind of figurehead billionaires, Gates, Soros, who have brilliant PR, incredible influence across media, turn up with the Clintons in Haiti before a disaster from which they doubtless profit. I wonder what you have to say about the significance of the philanthropist billionaire that's there to help you. What's their role in this?
Well, in my movie, Future Dreaming, I talk about the fact that philanthropy is the after-tax of unconsidered consumption. And I wish that people would actually take that seriously. It's the after-tax of unconsidered consumption. If you actually did enterprise correctly, there would be no need for philanthropy because you would have actually cared for the ecosystem in which you're operating, and nobody would be poor, and nobody would be destitute, and nobody would be in need of what philanthropy allegedly serves. So starting off with the construct, philanthropy itself is disgusting because what it is a way to launder your conscience after you've raped and pillaged the world. So starting with that little problem. But let's unpack this. You've just mentioned a bunch of names, but we just lost this past week Jim Simons, who's a name you haven't mentioned, and that's a shame because Jim Simons, far more powerful than George Soros ever was, is the guy who ran the Rentec funds and Meritage and all these kinds of things with the giant Republican donor Bob Mercer, who has been responsible for an enormous number of elections and election outcomes for the last couple decades. These guys were printing 60% at their peak, 60% returns on their transactions in their hedge funds and equity markets. And by the way, Russell, 60% returns are not because you're actually a smart person. 60% returns are because you are, once again, tapping into inaccessible, unpublic, rapid available information, which is uniquely afforded to you. And that's the reason why when we think about this convergence of the ultra powerful, the Michael Bloombergs of the world, the Jim Simonses, the late now Jim Simons, the Bob Mercers of the world, the Peter Thiels of the world, when we think about these individuals, what we have is a world in which George Soros becomes, not surprisingly, like Bill Gates, the public-facing boogeyman, But behind those people are even more powerful structures. And we need to understand that the structure at its core, and this, by the way, goes back to something as simple as the criminal conspiracy that took over the United Kingdom Health Services in the 1920s and the 1930s. Very specifically, the Wellcome Trust. Because the Wellcome Trust, which was the modern expression of the opium trade of the British East India Company, in 1941 set up what was called the Therapeutic Research Corporation in the UK, and that formed the basis for what would ultimately become the modern criminal organizations, the World Health Organization, and all of the stuff that the UN, League of Nations, and everything else did, as well as informing what became the FDA in the United States. But go back and ask the question, where did all this come from? And the answer is it actually came from the opium trade. It's the modern expression of the British East India Company, which happened to be unified under the Wellcome Trust. Nothing giant surprising about it. All of that money, all of it, came out of criminal drug trade.
I'm not going to sit here and let you blame Her Majesty the Queen, God rest her eternal soul, and Great Britain after all of our endeavors, our incredible flag,
yes,
the great things
great
we've
flag.
Done, William
yes.
Wilberforce, now, we, Shakespeare, some very, very fine people, and you, unavowedly, a member of one of our colonies, criticizing us in this manner.
So I know, it's disgusting. It's disgusting when you actually have something as simple as, I don't know, the charter that actually puts it all in motion.
So you're saying that these are like that. These like it's interesting because when you speak to people that have perhaps previously made an income in criminal ways, you know, organized crime. You have a version of that in North America. You have versions of that around the world, and in Britain, the sort of post-1960s style gangster culture has an incredible glamour to it. And in part, what you always feel is this: aside from the, you know, violence and the criminality, it's difficult to avoid the conclusion that really these are people that have bypassed systems that are supposed to repress and control them. And in a way, when you describe the enterprises that have grown out of, by your reckoning, and you say you have the receipts, and we totally want to see them, and I completely love this stuff, is that there are just criminal enterprises that are taking place on a much larger scale that kind of legislate in their wake to mask the criminal nature, creating whatever institutions or global entities required to frame, badge, and provide sigils and insignia that legitimize, well, we did this for the Queen of England. We did this for
Uncle Sam. Exactly. Well, listen, I mean, it's hilarious. You go to 1941, the Therapeutic Research Corporation, which was the Therapeutic Substances Act in the UK, and you go back and say, well, hold on a second. You mean that the biggest drug company in the UK set up the regulator for the drugs in the UK? So the company set up the regulator and continues to this day to fund the regulator. It's brilliant. It's so good because this is more creative than the mob could ever be. Because this is not, we get a couple of corrupt cops to look the other way. This is, we hire the police force. The police force are us. And so this is actually one step further. Remember, and I've said this many, many times, in the World Health Organization's founding charter, they wrote an absolute amnesty for all criminal acts conducted by themselves. Russell, I don't know how you would feel, but if by fiat, you and I just come to an agreement right now, wave our royal scepter and say, from now on, everything that Russell and Dave do are exempt from any prosecution of any kind in perpetuity. Thank you very much. A few people might raise their hand and go, I wonder if Russell and Dave are up to something. because it turns out that if you give yourself amnesty from all forms of criminal prosecution, including murder, by the way, let's get clear, you cannot be, by law, no member of the World Health Organization in the execution of anything they said they were doing in their own capacity as a World Health Organization, not a single one of them can not only be tried and prosecuted, they can't even be investigated.
Have you any, okay, of course.
By statute.
I take your premise that even the implementation of such a piece of regulation or legislation, global regulation. And it's extraordinary to see how often global regulation is being proposed these days. Of course, we've discussed the WHO treaty. Of course, we've not touched on Australia attempting to implement a piece of censorship legislation that would, by virtue of their attempts, they say, to bypass the capacities of VPN, be international and global. It's extraordinary. So what you're saying, Dave, is that at the inception of the WHO, they granted themselves somehow amnesty. Now, I wonder if there are examples in the history of the WHO of where that amnesty has been implemented or effective, or where its boundaries might likely be tested. Do you think in the pandemic period, during the HIV crisis, at what points are there likely to have been actions generated by people protected by that statute that, were they not offered those protections, they would have been prosecuted for the type of crimes?
Well, let's keep it really current. Remember that in 2018, during the Ebola clinical trials run by the World Health Organization in Africa, it was very clear that remdesivir, the drug that was promoted by Dr. Deborah Birx and Dr. Anthony Fauci as a drug for the treatment of COVID. Remember that in 2018, the World Health Organization, in its infinite wisdom and high morality, decided that remdesivir was actually too lethal to inject into Africans. And that is because the fatality rate of people exposed to remdesivir in the Ebola trials was 53%. And the bad news about that number is that Ebola doesn't kill 53%. You get over Ebola. You don't get over remdesivir. 53% of the people given that drug died. They were murdered. And it was so egregious that the drug was pulled from the clinical trials because it was unethical by World Health Organization standards. That's like saying that something's too hot by the devil's standards in hell, right? That's what that is. So let's just really be clear. We're not talking about a high moral compass there. We're talking about a holy shit. When you're telling me that the World Health Organization's morality meter got pegged, and they said in 2018, remdesivir was too deadly to use on Africans, that's a whole new level of, that feels like a line that probably shouldn't be crossed, which is the reason why every physician who injected a patient with remdesivir anywhere in the world was at least committing negligent homicide, if not willful murder. And because it was a standard of care during an emergency, you could kill people. And by the way, that's not, once again, it's not an allegation I'm making, it's an accusation I'm making, because the facts were all available. Every physician could have read the exact same documents I read. Everyone could have read the World Health Organization's interim report, which said that regardless of viral load, people that got remdesivir were killed. That means, Russell, the World Health Organization murdered people without Ebola in the clinical trial. Murdered them.
Do you see that particular set of staggering crimes that is difficult to comprehend because of their scale as forms of genocide and mass corruption often are, as somehow pertaining to the type of themes you refer to in much of your discourse elsewhere? Do you see that as being an outlier event, an anomaly, an aberration? Or do you see that as being part of a broader scheme that the WHO is participating in?
There's no question that, like any other theater of social engineering, the more egregious the crime, to steal a page from Plato. Remember, he talks about the fact that, you know, if a simple thief steals a loaf of bread, we call him a thief. If a organized group of young people steal a bunch of loaves of bread, we call it Oliver Twist. But there's a certain level at which a crime becomes so egregious that the sum of our emotional and spiritual awakening to the egregious nature of the crime is seared in its consciousness, and we actually start marveling at its audacity. We go from seeing a crime to pondering how somebody could have pulled it off, right? Think of a serial killer, right? one person kills one person, it's a murder. One person kills 10 people, we go, well, that was effort. One person kills 100 people, and we start going, let's do a discovery series on the mind of a serial killer. But when one person kills 1 million people, we don't have 1 million moments of consternation. We actually, as Plato observed, we flip the crime on its head and we start marveling at its audacity. And this is exactly the intent of what happened with COVID, because by marveling at the audacity of the fullness of the complicity of the horrific crimes that were done, we actually don't have a conscience to say every single person in a nursing home who was able to have a glass wall put between them so that they couldn't die in the arms of a loved one, every single person that was put into an ambulance and put on a respirator, which we knew was going to kill them, every single person who was put into a hospital and injected with remdesivir, every single one of them was a willful act of something that started in 1913 with the Carnegie Foundation, which was the eugenics program that is still absolutely alive and well at Cold Spring Harbor Labs. And by the way, go back and look at it. It was in the 1920s and the 1930s that Hitler was inspired by the work of the United States Eugenics Office. So let's not sit here and pretend that this is some sort of shock. Our willingness in the name of what we call public health and in the name of what we call science, our willingness to murder people, and I don't mean, oh, it was an accident kind of thing. I mean stuff like in 1920, when we went to orphanages and we poisoned children with radioactive oatmeal so that we could watch how they die. In the United States, that was not a, you know, concentration camp exercise. That was funded by and supported by the Eugenics Research Office here in the United States. That was injected digoxins. That was injected all kinds of other toxins. That was radiation exposure. And we did that with impunity on, are you ready for this? Orphans.
Yes.
In the 1960s, in the United States and in the UK. We had debates on whether it was ethical to use the incarcerated population for lethal drug studies because they were doing their time for society anyhow, so let's go ahead and kill them.
Eugenics emerges as an idea, in a sense, I suppose, from ideas perhaps that become popularized and in the Enlightenment, and emerge too from the theory of evolution, that yeah. Ultimately you can legitimize managing entire populations. And however grand a statement it might initially seem, we are dealing with civilian management. We are dealing with elite institutions and individuals within them making choices that affect entire populations, then undergirding those choices with new kinds of morality. One can see the necessity for the philanthropic component. It becomes, as described earlier, the way you used it in your film. What I feel is pretty fascinating, Dave, is that, like, that I know that you're a spiritual man. I know that you are investigating your relationship with Christ. What feels to me to be a possibility is that I'm talking just now about mainstream stories that help us to observe that, you know, when you talk about the emotional, personal experience that people would have had watching loved ones die behind, you know, glass, or going to a funerals on the internet and not being able to attend stuff, that stuff that became normalized and our kind of shared cultural amnesia and the giddying pace with which information seems to be broadcast and consumed allows that to move into the past. And as you have described, using sort of Plato's maxim, we can't even really comprehend that there are all organizations or individuals that would get orphans to ingest radioactive or oatmeal. I'm always like, oh, that's too big for me. I'm going to have to park that iceberg of terror elsewhere. It's too big for me to digest. But like, there's the AstraZeneca story now. AstraZeneca have withdrawn. Pfizer have settled a bunch of cases out of court because it's, you know, it looks like there's an implication that some of their anti-heartburn drugs cause cancer. Elsewhere, there are numerous claims that HIV medications were improperly researched and possibly punitive. I wonder what you seem to be describing is evil. You know, it goes beyond just rationalism, materialism, and we start to approach something and I noticed that you used the devil of hell himself to describe the WHO's potential standards there and moral compass pointing straight down to Hades. I wonder then where you see how personal and communal uplifting through spiritual practice becomes a necessary inoculation and counterpoint to the evil that we're discussing.
Well, so I think there's a couple angles that we can take on this, Russell, and I encourage people. And by the way, I just did an interview yesterday where I spoke at depth about my appreciation for your very public conversation recently about your own journey. I genuinely am in awe of what you're modeling, because I love the fact that humans are perpetually in an open inquiry, if they allow themselves to be, to make greater sense of the world in which they're operating. And I think the way you're doing it is actually absolutely luminous, and I really appreciate it. But let me make a couple observations. It was in the 3rd and 4th century, in the Common Era, that we decided to adopt a view that became in the institutional Latin church an idea of original sin. Ironically, from a mistranslation and ultimately an illiteracy of the writings of the Apostle Paul himself, because one of the things that people don't bother reading is that while the doctrine of original sin comes from the statement that says, you know, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, or, you know, as in Adam came death, and all these kinds of references from the Bible, ironically, people don't even finish reading the sentence, which is as in Christ comes life, which means that the way the document is actually written suggests that this idea that somehow we're all a broken and failed state is actually an illusion for the control of a population rather than the emancipation, which is what the message of Christ was. The message of Christ was, let him without sin cast the first stone. The message of Christ was, sit with the tax collectors, sit with the people who are not like you, sit with the people who are outside the approved narrative, sit with all of those people and actually break bread with them. That's what that message was. And what we've done, and I've said this many times, we could not have had asymptomatic spread of COVID without original sin. As a carrier frequency idea, we could not have the possibility that someone could tell you you're sick, because remember, COVID was a series of symptoms. So you couldn't have asymptomatic COVID because it doesn't exist. COVID was only symptoms. So if you didn't have a concept in our minds that was delivered by religion that said you could be created in the image and likeness of God and still be a piece of shit, which is the church's official dogma and narrative since the 4th century, it turns out that if you didn't have that carrier frequency, nobody would have believed asymptomatic COVID, because the idea that I can be perfectly healthy, I can be out running, I can be out jogging, I can be out in the park, I can be out with my family, and I'm an asymptomatic spreader, that comes from the logic framework, the ontology that says you can be born into the perfection of this world and be broken on arrival, which is bullshit. We have to get to a clear picture. And this is what I love about your journey that you've played out very publicly for the world to see, which is that if we had a story of the emancipation of a Christ consciousness that says, hey, it's a bigger thing than you, buddy. This is about, when you see the naked, do you clothe them? When you see the hungry, do you feed them? When you see your brother and sister in need, do you actually reach out to them? If you, God forbid, followed the teachings of Christ, what you would do is you'd find yourself in a very different world. And I have said many times, COVID was only successful, and this is actually objectively the case, COVID was only successful in countries with Occidental cultural narratives around a Judeo-Christian template of original sin. Take that away, and you don't have COVID. Because the countries where you didn't have people dying of it, and you didn't have people falling off the wagon, you didn't have all these giant outbreaks, were countries that actually don't think that when you're born, you're broken. And my point is simple. This is a spiritual battle, but the spiritual battle lives inside each one of us. Because the goal is not to sit here in judgment and say, oh, there are bad actors doing bad things. Yes. You know what? Just like the poor you'll always have with you. Well, guess what? The evil you will always have with you. There will always be people who actually have given themselves over to darkness. For what? For greed, for power, for corruption, for all the controls that they want. And those people will be around. But if we actually had a good news message of the emancipation of what it means to actually live in the fullness of your created purpose, you wouldn't fall for the games.
Hmm.
No one would. And so I do think it's an invitation to a deeper examination. I really do. And I think it's great. Like I said, I mean, I think it's great that you're playing a role model, very, very explicit kind of John the Baptist moment of actually going, hey, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm doing the best I know, and I'm living the experience I'm having, and I'm surrounded by people who are holding me accountable. And those are the things that actually enrich our lives.
Thank you for this beautiful compliment. There is also a lot to unpack theologically and epistemologically there. I like the idea of a molecular paradigm that affords the contagion to operate because the archetypal and psychic space has been created for it.
Exactly.
I would like to add to your earlier point about sort of globalism and corporatism begins with the establishment of the East India Tea Company and the relationships inhered within it. I would like to perhaps use a similar conversational device, although I'm actually, we're going to have to wrap this up, which kills me because I enjoy talking to you so much. I note that when you refer to the corrupting influences or within ecclesiastical circles, you point to 400 years AD as a significant moment around the conversion of Constantine, when the state utilizes and potentially metastasizes the principles of the early Christians. Christianity, it seems to me, in its essence, is a rebellious idea, and it is an anti-establishment idea, and it is a radical opposition to materialism, and perhaps the to use a kind of rhetorical device that you are using, that perhaps the molecule of self is the inception of materialism. Once I believe in the idea of Russell, the business of Russell, and that the God of Russell is the one that has to be served, then I am a closed off unit. I can I'm on the circuit board of the system now. But when I say, oh no, Russell wasn't real, I'm out, then something radical happens. And I suppose my conversion has been because I saw that that is what Christ is offering. And before, I did not see that. Now I see it.
Yeah.
Now I see what it is.
And it begs a question. I mean, if we actually were able to take a step back and just say, hold on, do we have a broken narrative of self? Because if we saw ourselves as the sentient exception, so each individual one of us is a manifestation, is a sentient exception, which is in the universe right now, having the experiences we're having to feed information back into the whole from our experience. It doesn't mean that we are throwing ourselves into some sort of self-deprecation. We're actually inflating the importance of activating all of our senses to make sure that we're very aware, to make sure that we're actually doing all the inquiries we can, because every one of those is in service to the wisdom of the whole. So it is not an absence of individuation from the standpoint of function, right? Because individually, you have a function. Individually, I have a function. But my identity is not that function.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the point.
Yes.
That is what a Christ awareness is, which is it's not about me. If you see, what did Jesus say? If you see me, you see the Father. He's not saying I am a thing. He's saying that if I'm living rightly, then through my acts, through my deeds, through my words, through the way in which I engage in my world, I'm modeling a thing. And if you see what I'm modeling, that's the template that you could live by. He at no point said, I am that thing. He said, through me, you will see a thing. And that's where I think we've probably lost so much of the narrative of the beauty of it, because once you are there, once you are in that role, you know, when I make a statement about the World Health Organization, about the United Nations, about COVID, about Anthony Fauci, what I'm doing is I'm simply saying through the words I'm sharing, what I'm trying to show is the essence of the archetype in which we're operating, where the structures of this world are currently hijacking the sovereignty of humanity, the beauty of the created order, the wonder of a world that does not require gain-of-function research legitimized in October of 2014 by NIAID, by Anthony Fauci, on the Wuhan Institute of Virology Coronavirus 1. We don't need that world. And we don't need that world because the world in its created order actually works.
David, that is very, very beautiful. Thank you so much for explaining that so elegantly and articulately, and for moving between realms, for bringing your receipts and showing your working out and making the whole thing so enjoyable with your effortless abilities as a raconteur as well as a science communicator. It's very valuable, Dave. Thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Always honored, Russell. I always am honored. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for joining us for our conversation with Dave Martin. Remember to see these conversations live when they happen. Become an awakened wonder. We do additional content every single week. Become a part of our growing movement. Support us when you can. See you next week. Not for more of the same, but for more of the different. Until then, if you can, stay free. Many switch in, switch on, switch off. Many switch in, switch on, switch off.